Use your mind, close your eyes, see with your heart. How do you forgive the murderer of your father? The ink of a scholar is worth a thousand times more than the blood of a mob. Terrorists. Yeah. We came through the storm, nooses on our necks, and a smallpox blanket to keep us warm on a 747 on the Pentagon lawn. Wake up, the alarm clock is connected to a bomb. Anthrax lab on a West Virginia farm. Shorty ain't learned to walk, already heavily armed. Civilians and little children is especially harmed. Camouflage Taurus, Bibles and glorious Qurans. The books that take you to heaven and let you meet the Lord there have become misinterpreted reasons for warfare. We read them with blind eyes, I guarantee you there's more there. Rich must be blind, cause they ain't see the poor.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the radio show going all out for truth. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you great guests, raising all sorts of really taboo issues in many cases, as well as the big questions that have only a narrow spectrum of appropriate answers in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Let's look outside the box and see what we see today. I'm going to be talking with Ibrahim Sudi. He's a highly qualified PhD structural engineer, member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and he's an American Muslim who has been thinking about the future of Islam and where Muslims go from here. The world has, by some counts, anywhere between a little under 1.5 billion to some say close to 2 billion Muslims, and from a very wide variety of cultures, degrees of education, outlooks, perspectives, worldviews, approaches to Islam, approaches to everything. And so this is a really big topic. I think we can probably barely scratch the surface in an hour, but let's go for it. Welcome, Ibrahim Sudi. How are you?
I'm fine, Kevin. Thank you very much. And thanks for the generous introduction.
Well, it's good to have you back on the show. You know, I appreciate that you are kind of working both sides of the street, the scientific, technological side, and also thinking about the big questions of life. And I think that's one of the problems that we have in the, not just in the Muslim world, but all over the world today, is that none of us are really, you know, full rounded human beings, spiritually, educationally, you know, so we have specialists in everything. And here in the US, a lot of Muslims are urged by their parents to become professionals in things like engineering or law or medicine, especially. And they don't get that so-called humanities education or the education history, philosophy, and religion. And we, you know, we end up with a middle class that is unable to fight back when something like 9/11 happens and the world is stampeded into a war on Islam.
Yeah, this is this is very true. And it's unfortunate, actually, that the world today has been shaped by events that kind of carry people with them. It's like a flood, and people are carried in the flood rather than actually people are determining where they are going to go or what they want the future to look like, all the stuff like that. If you look at humanity today, you will find that we are far more reactionaries than we are creative, making the world the way we would like it to be. And I think that's not a good direction to be going into. And humanity, like I said, has been going in that direction for quite a while. And it's unfortunate that we as Muslims almost have forgotten, actually, that our role in the world is not to be reactionaries, is not to be just responding to the falsehoods that others spread about Islam. Actually, we were supposed to be out there proactive, showing the world what this thing is all about. And it's amazing that if you look at the foundations of the Western world today, in terms of technological advantages, advances, and things like that, you will find that they are rooted in what Muslims actually have brought in the world by preserving the old sciences and the philosophies from the Greeks and the Romans before them and so on, or the Romans after the Greeks. You look at what people call the Golden Age of Islam, and you find that Baghdad was the center of science and technology as well as humanities. So like you said, today even Muslims in America are encouraged more by their parents to go into science and engineering and law and stuff like that. But you don't hear much about philosophy or about humanities or about political even involvement. That's why we Muslims are very inactive politically in America, with very limited exceptions, of course. So I do agree with you that the topic of Islam and what it is and our role as Muslims and where do we go from here, I think is a very, very important topic to discuss. And that's what I am here to scratch the surface, like you said, with you.
Okay. Well, I think one of the appealing things about Islam to many people, including some people who on the surface are anti-Islam, is that Islam is still an intact religion with a complete worldview and even a kind of an idea of a good society. It all kind of works, fits together. It gives people a way of interpreting their lives and of living meaningful lives. And it even psychologically, I think, has a little bit of this kind of great secret that we also see in Buddhism. You know, in Buddhism, people are taught that we should practice non-attachment from our desires, and that, you know, our lives are a constant sort of mishmash of feeling good about one thing and feeling bad about something else, desiring this and avoiding and hating that. And in Buddhism, there are very rigorous techniques for the serious Buddhists to get past that and to practice a kind of non-attachment that leads to total serenity. And Islam has something a bit like that with its concept of the nafs al-mutma'inna, the peaceful soul, and the notion of submission, which is what Islam means. Absolute submission to God, in a sense, means accepting that the world is perfect as it is, and that therefore our nafs, or our ego, which wants one thing and hates another thing, needs to be gotten over. And so there's that psychological wisdom, which I think it's still there. And people who are practicing Islam, praying five times a day, fasting for Ramadan, reading Quran, and essentially following the religion, typically do achieve a greater level of inner peace than those who don't. So it's working. And yet, as far as producing a culture that is a notable success in the world around, as we look at it today, it's got kind of mixed reviews. On the one hand, we hear Muslims are behind technologically and scientifically. They don't have enough Nobel Prizes. And on the other hand, we hear from people like Dr. Javed Jamil that Muslim societies are actually doing very well overall, very, you know, lower levels of negative social indicators. So how do we put all this together? Is it too big a subject to even come up with a single opinion on?
Well, I am not really sure I would say it's too big a subject. I think things usually are better, and they work even better when you keep it simpler. Like the issue is, for example, yeah, you mentioned stuff about Buddhism and holding yourself back from particular desires or wanting too much of something and hating something for no reason and stuff like that. And actually, if you look at the Sufis, you find that this is exactly the same thing. Right. However, there are many people in the world now that actually consider Sufism and Islam to be two different things. And that again goes back to our lack as Muslims in going out and explaining to people what that is. I don't know if many people know that or not, but the most sold poet in the West, in America and in Canada, is actually Jalaluddin Rumi, who died some 800 years ago or so. So many people actually here are willing to go buy books by Jalaluddin Rumi and read them in English, which is a translation to the original Persian or Arabic. And imagine if they find it so beautiful and meaningful and fulfilling to them on some spiritual, emotional, intellectual level. Can you imagine if they were able to read the same poetry in the original language that Rumi used? People think that Sufism and Islam are two different things. And like I said, this is the crux actually of the problem that's facing us today as Muslims, is we created all these names but actually we failed to refer them to back to the original word that should have been the umbrella under which all these names would come, which is Islam. So I get kind of bothered, if you will, when I hear people talking about Rumi, but on the other hand, they do not really know that Rumi actually was a devout Muslim, and I don't blame them for that. I look at us as Muslims and say, did we really do a good job in informing the world and the rest of humanity about us, about what we have done and stuff like that? So let's take it from here. Let's start by these different names. Like today, for example, to non-Muslim or even a young Muslim, they hear about Sunnis and Shiites and then Sufis. And then they hear about ISIS and Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda. And people do not know which one is Islam and which one is not.
And most of this is not very mainstream Islam. Most of this is, you know, a terrorist group that's being demonized in the media.
Well, but this is the problem again, is that actually we have now the fringes of some people who call themselves Muslims, like, for example, ISIS and Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and all that, which you jumped in and referred to them as terrorist groups, which I have my reservations on using the word terrorist, because actually using drones to kill people without putting them on trial, to me, actually, is a form of terrorism.
Well, I agree. So, I was referring to the media image.
Yeah, so let's be careful now. But this is the job of you and I now, to try to kind of counter what the media is misinforming people or putting wrong information in the minds of people. Yeah. So refrain from using words like terrorism and stuff like that for this discussion. Yeah. I am just trying to go back to what is Islam and how do all these names, Sunni, Shiite, Sufi, Wahhabi, Salafi, you hear all these names. And to non-Muslims as well as young Muslims, the issue has become very confused. And the silent majority of Muslims who do not actually like to call themselves Sunnis or Shiites or Salafis or Wahhabis or Sufis or any of that, the silent majority is not informing the world of what they think of what Islam really is. Although, like you said, in some cases, they have created actually societies that overall, it might not be very advanced technologically, but if you look at them on balance in terms of every aspect of the society they have, I think it's much better than some societies that might be very, very advanced technologically, but on a humane level, the issue is very bad. And let me give a specific example here. Let's look at the United States of America, the most technologically advanced country in the world, but it also has more prisons and more people imprisoned in that society per capita than any other society in the world. So we're like, here you might be very, very strong technologically, but actually on a human level, on a societal level, on a society, you haven't done very good. So is that a good model to be very advanced technologically? But you have nearly 100 people every day in America, every day 100 people gunned down by guns in violence. So is this really a good model that we should be following? So let's go back again to what Islam is and where do all these names come from, and then touch a little bit on our role as Muslims now and what we should be going from here. And this is a good opportunity because today is a very significant day in the history of Islam, Ashura, and that is the 10th day of the first month of the Muslim calendar. And it has some significance because the foundation of the split that happened between mainstream Muslims at one point and what became known as Shia today, it started on events, by events that started on this very day. So this is a very good opportunity for us to talk about that. And I don't know, are there very specific questions that you want to...
Let's talk a little bit about Ashura. You know, one way to approach it is that as I said on Press TV the other day, that it's kind of confusing to me why we see this kind of strife between Sunni and Shia Muslims on Ashura. There was a suicide bombing in Pakistan at a Muharram procession, when in fact, it seems that if we look at what Sunni and Shia Muslims are doing on Ashura, we don't see really why there's such a difference. The Shia are mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the prophet's grandson, and Sunnis also mourn Imam Hussein, and both sides agree that he was a martyr who died in a just cause, and he was far, far better than the people who killed him and who set up that Umayyad dynasty. So that's the Shia say this very, very strongly and emotionally, and the Sunnis agree with it, only a little bit less strongly and emotionally. And then the other aspect of Ashura, the Sunnis are celebrating the liberation of the people of Moses. So there's no real major difference in interpretation here. So why is there a split in the way that Ashura is observed, and how does this lead to conflict within the Muslim community?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question, actually, to start with. And I fully agree with you that Muslims in general and the Shia sect of Muslims, I will always keep saying that. Like, I will not say Sunnis and Shia. No. I will say Muslims in general and then the Shia sect of Islam.
Wait a minute. That's not fair. I mean, a Shia would say Muslims in general and the, you know, misguided Sunni sect. I mean, it kind of already is taking a position to call one side a sect.
No. I disagree with that, because you are a linguist on some level, and I also care very much about the meaning of the word. Yeah. The word Sunni itself is actually redundant. Like, the word Sunni comes from someone who follows the Sunnah, and the Sunnah is the practice of Muhammad. Well, you can't be a Muslim if you don't follow the practice of Muhammad. So the word Sunni actually somehow and the word Muslim are more or less the same thing. The word Shia actually came originally. It was not Shia. It was the Shia of Ali, or the supporters of Ali. It was kind of a political movement.
Right, but that word was applied by their enemies. That's not what the Shia Muslims think of themselves as, the party of the family of Muhammad.
Well, like I say, the issue here is more political. Like, the names, the different names, kind of a more political thing rather than... And when I say political, I'm not talking about political in the terms of Republicans and Democrats and stuff like that. No. The main split between the different groups of Muslims, let me call it this way, is that who should have the succession of leading the Ummah, the Muslim people, politically? Who should be the leader of the Ummah? Who should be the one installed to fulfill the role that Muhammad used to fulfill when he was alive, as a head of state, as a head of the group, as the head of the Ummah politically, economically, militarily, and then other aspects of life as well. So the main problem today between Muslims in general, or what you refer to them as Sunnis, yeah, which are the vast majority of Muslims, almost 90% or even more than that, and the Shia group, stems from this issue. Like I say, how do we relate to who should the leader should be of the Muslim Ummah as a group, as an entire body, one body, who should be the leader? The Shia group thinks that he has to have blood relationship to Muhammad himself. Like, there has to be kind of blood lineage between the leader of the Muslim Ummah and Muhammad. That's mainly on the Shia side. Yeah. The rest of Muslims, who are the vast majority of the Muslims, actually do not see that as a condition. And they even have real practical examples of that from the life of, from the history that followed Muhammad himself, that the first three leaders of Muslims, Abu Bakr, and then followed by Umar ibn al-Khattab, and then followed by Uthman, none of them actually had blood relationship to Muhammad. So they say here that even from the very, very early history of Islam, this blood relationship thing is not really a condition of the leader of the Muslim Ummah. It's
right,
a matter
but of I'm not sure that's an accurate description of the perspective of all Shia. I know that Hamid Algar probably the greatest Muslim Islamologist in the United States, has basically become what one would call a Shia, because his exhaustive studies of the early sources show, to him at least, that the Shia perspective is correct, and that it's not has nothing to do with just saying that it must be a descendant of Muhammad, but rather very specific instances, such as the textual evidence that Prophet Muhammad did put the future leadership role on Ali while he was alive, and that Professor Algar and some others are convinced that this is the evidence suggests that this was in fact true, and that therefore there was a misappropriation of leadership when the caliphate began with Abu Bakr, and that this may not have, you know, we don't need to demonize the rightly guided caliphs to accept that this is a possibility. And then finally, that the martyrdom at Karbala did inaugurate a long history of misrule of Muslim societies, and that the people who have ruled most Muslim societies throughout all of history have in fact been bloody despots and tyrants, and still are for the most part.
Well, see, this is exactly the kind of thing that I am calling for, an intra-Islam dialogue. I want people who are highly educated, who know stuff, to come out, and let's have a dialogue, and let's try to see where do we really go from here. Because to me, for example, one of the main reasons why there is this kind of tension, if you will, between Muslims in general, or the majority that I like to refer to them, some people like to call them Sunnis, and then the Shia group, is in what happens actually in particular on the day like today. Is, for example, you find that some, not all, of the Shia group would go out holding some like knives and chains and stuff like that, have processions, and then kind of hit themselves with the knives and the chains in public, and do things like that, which kind of like add to the this split, this kind of fear of the other, if you will, on the part of the majority of Muslims who do not do that stuff. Like I don't do that stuff. I am sad for what happened on that day to Imam Hussein, like anybody else, because we who are not, like I as a person who do not call myself Shia, feel saddened by what happened. And the family of Muhammad is just as important as anybody else, and we love them and everything, but we just don't go out and hitting ourselves with knives and the chains and stuff like that. And I'm glad to report, actually, that in my talking with some Shia scholars, they assured me, actually, that some of them are working very hard to stop these practices that actually have nothing to do with Islam. Like, I'm delighted to hear that some of them are recommending to their fellow Shia to actually go donate blood, for example, in blood centers on a day like this, rather than hit themselves with knives and then let the blood run on the ground and on bathroom floors and stuff like that. So I'm pointing out two things here. On the one hand, the old practices of having processions and flagging oneself with the chains or knives or all that stuff is existing, and is splitting people even more apart, putting Sunnis who do not, Muslims who do not do that stuff, and the Shia people who do that stuff further apart, is pushing them apart. But on the other hand, the good news is that some of the Shia scholars themselves are fighting these practices and asking the people to stop doing that, because it has nothing to do really with Islam. Mm-hmm. This is a good thing. So where do we go from here as Muslims? I am saying, and I'm actually...
Well, could I can interrupt you just for a moment on that. I agree with you. I'm sort of, you know, just trying to offer another view. I have gotten to know various Shia people in my travels to Iran and elsewhere, and I've developed a certain kind of respect for the fact that today the leading Muslim country is clearly Iran, and that the Shia global community clearly is the avant-garde in many respects of the Muslim community. And as far as the flagellation on Ashura, certainly that's not a practice that appeals to me either. And I am glad to hear that there are scholars recommending against it. On the other hand, one could make the point that the willingness to live with tyrannical leadership that has murdered the true righteous rulers and put demons in their place throughout the world, this isn't just a Muslim problem, this is everywhere in the world. We are suffering under just an outrageous level of misrule in the entire world. And I almost wish, Ibrahim, that Americans on November 22nd every year would go out in the streets and flagellate themselves to remember the martyrdom of John F. Kennedy, who was murdered by the same kinds of evil forces that the Shia believe murdered Imam Hussein. That is, that it's one thing, you know, to say, yeah, that's an exaggeration. But it's another thing to say, you know, the real error is with people who are willing to live under tyranny. And that, you know, at least expressing your hatred of tyranny in a really powerful way is better than keeping your mouth shut. You know, that there's the famous hadith, I believe, that isn't the hadith that says that if you see something wrong, you know, you must try to change it with your hands. And if you can't change it with your hands, you have to speak out against it with your tongue. And if you can't speak out against it with your tongue, you must at least hate it with your heart. Any kind of tyranny or injustice, and the level of tyranny and injustice in this world has been so off the scale that, frankly, in some ways, I think it's the people who aren't going out and self-flagellating over this injustice who are crazy.
Oh, no. I do agree with you on some level, but I disagree in the overall picture. I am not saying that people
I'm being rhetorical here, Ibrahim, of course. I'm not telling you to run out and start flagellating
yourself. But see, you don't even need to bring a religion into the pictures, the picture, in order to talk about fighting tyranny. Like, fighting tyranny is supposed to be the case, whether you are a Muslim or non-Muslim, whether you even believe in God at all. Like, fighting tyranny should be a human cause and a human activity all the time, and we don't disagree on that. But the issue is to say, hitting yourself with a knife or a chain is better than not doing anything at all. I'm not saying that doing anything at all is a good thing. I'm saying that hitting yourself with a knife or a chain or something like that can cause a kind of repulsion, can make people not even want to come close to you, because you are just like, if you see person silent, you don't know if the person is angry. Like you said yourself, that when you see something wrong, you're supposed to change it with your hand if you can, of course, peacefully. If you can't, you change it by your word, you say something against it, and then if you can't, you at least have negative feeling towards it by your heart. Yeah. So if some people are not fighting tyranny in the way that we would like them to, we can just assume that, oh, they are happy with it, or they are satisfied with it. No. We can't go into that. We can't draw that conclusion. Yeah. So I'm just focusing now on dealing with the issue that causes more separation between the let me call them the people who have common sense, the people who are sane in the Muslim world who are not Shia. When they see the Shia groups that go out and hit themselves with knives and stuff like that, that's what I'm trying to create here, is that stopping this kind of practice will help bring the different factions together and make the dialogue between them more possible and more fruitful, hopefully, in the future. That's the main point I'm trying to make so far.
Okay.
In terms of fighting tyranny itself, yes, this is actually what I mean by where do we go from here. There are so many Muslims around the world who are living under tyranny. I can assure you, because I come from a country exactly like that, I can assure you that the people in those countries are not really happy or satisfied with the tyrants that are running their societies. No, that would be very unfair to say. On the other hand, also is not fair to say that they are doing nothing to fight it. No, like we have seen recently in country like Egypt, for example, where the people rose against the dictatorship of Mubarak, and then we all celebrated Tahrir Square and all that stuff. And then again, the deep state and the foreign influence, mainly the bribe that the U.S. government gives the Egyptian military every year, encouraged the military to make a coup again and remove the democratically elected president of Egypt and then bring back military dictatorship. So I can't actually say that from what happened, that the vast majority of the Egyptian people, who actually happen to be not Shia people, are happy with the tyranny that they have. No, that would be a very wrong conclusion to have. I know from talking personally to Saudi Arabian people, people from Saudi Arabia, that they are very unhappy with the dictatorship they have. And some of them are doing stuff. And if you go on the internet, you will find Saudis in exile in countries like the United Kingdom and in other places in the world who are speaking up against the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia. So let's not say that, if you don't go out and hit yourself with a knife, then you are happy with the dictatorship, and that means that you're not a good... No. I don't want to make that conclusion at all.
I agree. I think it's better to go out and do something to make the world better rather than simply expressing your frustration, whether by howling or hitting yourself or anything like that. Just pure expression of the emotional response is probably, in most cases, not very productive. But again, one can sort of see how in Christianity, there's a long history of this kind of, you know, what some people would call masochistic religious rituals as well. And they don't make a very good sort of image of that religion, especially in today's world. You know, we look back at the Christians who used to do these kinds of self-flagellation rituals far more in more extreme fashion than these Shia processors do today. And people today just can't understand that.
That's a good point that you are making there. So where do we go from here? Here is the first recommendation or suggestion on my part, is that I think anybody who consider themselves to be Muslims, let me put it this way, anybody out there who considers him or herself to be a Muslim, regardless of now how you will classify yourself down under, I am asking those people to go out and seek and build dialogues with other people who also call themselves Muslims. Don't start by asking whether you are Sunni or Shia or Sufi or Salafi or Wahhabi. No. As long as we have this word in common, as long as you describe yourself as a Muslim, regardless of now how you practice Islam from your own experience. No. As long as you consider yourself a Muslim, then go out and have an intra-Islam dialogue, kind of like the interfaith dialogue when people of different religions come together. No, let's bring everybody who calls him or herself Muslim out there together and organize either a potluck dinner or a salon discussion or a discussion group or a book club or something, and let's learn a little bit about each other. Because I, as a Muslim, for example, would like to know how many subgroups in the main group that calls itself Shia, because I know also from the little I studied and the information I have is that they do not all agree on the same thing. Like, there is not just one big block out there called Shia. No. There are different Shia groups, and they have either different practices sometimes and different things they believe in, especially when it comes to the nature of Ali. Because I heard some stuff, and I don't know if the writers who wrote that stuff really represented the true Shia people or not, but I heard that some people talk about whether Ali received the Quran before Muhammad or was born reciting the Quran, and Jibril made an error, and instead of delivering the Quran to Ali, delivered it to Muhammad. So there are things.
I think that's disinformation, probably. And to some extent, it could be folklore within Shia communities where uneducated people pass things down. But and I'm sure educated Shia people do not say these things. But it is interesting, though, that Sufi mystics, that is people of the Sufi brotherhoods and approach, tend to also look to Ali as the real heir of the Prophet's deepest teachings.
Well, I see this is now an issue that I think is really needs a kind of a conference or a big discussion, because as you know, and I will give an example from a different religion, actually. We all know how big Moses is as a prophet in Judaism and even in the history of Islam itself, because Moses would be considered also a prophet of Islam. We believe in him exactly as we believe in Muhammad. In the Quran, there is a surah called The Cave, and it has a story about how God wanted to show Moses that being a prophet doesn't mean that you actually have knowledge about God itself, more than maybe some people who are not even prophets. Like, you know the story when he went looking for this knowledgeable man that God talked about and said that God gave that man in his heart knowledge that did not even give to Moses. Yeah. The man told Moses that you will not be patient with me, and he told him, I promise that I will be patient. And then they rode in a ship, and then the man did something in the ship that Moses thought that was not right, and then the man told him, see, I told you will not be patient, and so on. So if you even go into that, you will find that there are people who are not prophets, that God has put knowledge in their heart that might not have given even to prophets. Yeah. Yes. So the issue of the heir to the prophet and stuff like that, this is a big subject to talk about. And
it might be a little too esoteric, because probably most of our audience is not Muslim and may start to get lost if we get too esoteric. Maybe we should reel it back in taking into consideration your call for intra-Muslim dialogue, which is great and just perfect for the USA, where we have Muslims from everywhere, all different kinds of Muslims here. I was just hanging out with Nation of Islam people in Washington, D.C. at the Justice or Else event. So the USA is the place for that. But let's keep in mind that a lot of the audience is not Muslim and probably has been exposed to propaganda and misinformation. And where would you start in terms of discussing how where Islam can go in a way that takes into consideration this kind of world where everybody's in communication that we have now?
Yeah, like I say, I think the main thing that we as Muslims now need to do is to start this intra-Islam dialogue. And thank goodness, within, I think, 10 days, I am holding here in Seattle the first event of intra-Islam dialogue, where I'm asking Muslims of different schools of thought and different political views and different even religious views to come together, and let's start this practice again of inter-dialogue, inter-Islam, inter-Muslim dialogue, in order to somehow agree on a message that we put out there, so that non-Muslims can see what the majority of Muslims are doing and are talking about, and can see actually now where mainstream Muslims are in relation to the fringes that are following or filling the news with their stuff that quite frankly has nothing to do with Islam or even any sane human thinking to start with. So this inter-Islam dialogue is very important, and I'm asking my fellow Muslims out there to go out and seek other Muslims and try to create this dialogue and be patient with each other. Instead of jumping and judging on whether they are right or wrong, just try to listen to their point of view and then see how you can counter that if you disagree with, in a way that's productive, that can enhance the quality of the dialogue and make people understand each other better. That's number one. And that's one track. The other track is, and this is more global now, I'm calling also for my fellow Muslims everywhere in the world, whether they are listening to us on the radio or on the internet, following what you write and stuff like that, is that there is an organization out there called the Organization of Islamic Conference. The Organization of Islamic Conference. And it has a membership of about 57 or so Muslim countries. I would like this organization actually to either be converted into an organization that organizes a global dialogue between Muslims in general in the whole world, or we create a parallel organization for this global Muslim dialogue. Like, it's not just Muslims locally talking to each other. No. I want to create a global Muslim dialogue. And I will venture actually to say that if the Europeans can come together and create something called the European Union, we all know how the Europeans are different from each other in terms of religion, in terms of politics, in terms of even culture. But they came together and created a European Union. I don't see why not. Why can't we Muslims have the Muslim Union? Why can't we have an organization, whether converting the existing organization of Islamic countries, or we create a parallel organization to bring Muslims in the world in something called the Muslim Union along the lines of the European Union? If America can come together and through 50 different states create something called the United States of America, I don't know of any reason that would prevent us Muslims from creating something along the same lines.
Well, it should be easier, Ibrahim, because if we compare the two cases with the Europeans, as you suggested, there are many different countries, different languages, different identities. Nobody ever really thought of themselves as a European as their first identity, whereas in the Muslim world, being a Muslim is the first identity, the first nation is the Muslim Ummah, and then there's a common language. Arabic is the scriptural language of Islam, and a certain amount of familiarity with High Arabic is quite basic today. It's not hard to get from the media and from studying the religion. So we have a common identity, we have a common language, a common religion, a common culture, and even people who are not Muslims religiously, including many Christians and Jews as well, from majority Muslim countries, do partake of this, what Marshall Hodgson called Islamic culture. So there are all these different levels of unity, plus currency. You know, they had to come up with the euro out of nothing. But in the Islamic world, there is a tradition of the gold dinar and silver dirham as the currency in which zakat, the Muslim charity, has to be paid. So we already have the identity, we have the language, we have the religion, we have the culture, we have the currency. It's all there. Muslim unity should be a no-brainer, and yet we're not very close to that. Why not?
Well, like I say, because there are not many people like I am doing now. I was there speaking about that. Like, we need to not let ISIS define what Islam is or what Muslims do or what the Islamic State is. No. We need people like you and I and all educated Muslims out there who have lived in different cultures and in different societies and know things, come out and come together and reshape the culture of Muslims. Because you said that our first identity is Muslim. I'm not really sure that the majority of Muslims actually do that in practice. Like, mm-hmm. If that was the case, actually, the dialogue between Muslims should be in a continuous thing and shouldn't be something that I would be calling for now. No, that should have been existing all along, on a global level, yeah.
That is rooted in history. The European identity is not rooted in history, but the Muslim one is.
No, I do agree with you, but I'm saying it's just, it's something to talk about an issue in theory versus whether it's really happening or not. I agree with everything you say, that actually the unity between Muslims should be far easier than the unity between Europeans. It should be far easier. Yeah. I even add to that all what you listed as a religion, culture, language, currency, and so on and so forth. I will even add to that we have an annual Muslim conference that brings Muslims from all over the world as part of even the foundations of Islam itself, and that's called the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage to Mecca should be an international conference, in part. Like, I know that it's mainly spiritual and a religious practice, but I don't see any reason why not attached to that as part of the Hajj, after people finish the rituals of the Hajj itself, that they would have an international conference with people representing Muslims from every corner of the world, from every country, from every region, holding a conference to talk about what are the main problems people are facing in different parts of the world, so that they become aware of the issues and also become aware of the activities that they are all doing in order to advance themselves locally in the regions, so that if there is a good practice working somewhere and could be copied everywhere else, that would be. So I am also calling for Muslims out there who are in agreement with me to also push for things like that, that we need to take advantage of this rituals that we do, like, for example, pilgrimage, to add to it as part of the being in one place and in the same environment, to create an international conference for Muslims representing different regions and countries in the world, to have a dialogue and kind of build the bridges between Muslims. That would be a second thing I am calling for. The first is local dialogues between Muslims who call themselves Muslims to learn about other Muslims and learn from them and have a debate about issues that they disagree on, and also do research. Like when you disagree on something, agree to disagree and then go out, do research, and then next time bring something either to support what you said earlier or to say to the other person that, yes, now after doing research, I see your point and I agree with you and I was not right in the first place. There is nothing wrong with that. So that would be the second thing. The third thing, actually that was the third thing now, because I said three things. Number one, the local dialogue. Number two, the global dialogue via the Organization of Islamic Conference or a parallel organization to be made. The third thing is this conference. Annual conference as part of the Hajj to have Muslims from different regions in the world building bridges between each other. So well, those are three things I would be calling for.
That sounds good. And how about the dawah or outreach to non-Muslims? Because there's been all sorts of paranoia in the West, which I think is founded on suspicion that Western civilization has already passed its peak, that individuals in Western civilization today are cut off from their communities, their families. They're very atomized, and the state and the market are what mediate their lives, not other people. And this is not a natural way for people to live, and people end up chasing material goods and pleasures that are ultimately unsatisfying. And so the way of life, I think, in a sense, is really the root of the problem. I mean, we have environmental issues, we have political and issues and possibilities of war and resource depletion, all these things. But ultimately, I think it's based in the problem of this way of life, of broken apart individuals facing life and, you know, not having any family community ties and not having any metaphysical rationale, not having any real meaning or purpose in their lives. And so I think that that is what is partly driving the Islamophobia that has reigned in the Western world, at least since 9/11. And there's this subconscious realization that the Western way of life isn't sustainable, that it's wrong somehow. And here is Islam, a monotheistic religion very close to Christianity, that is actually still functioning to some extent, providing its practitioners with a satisfying purpose to life, with intact communities and families to some extent. And I think there's a kind of jealousy or envy or maybe fear of another culture being more successful that is the underlying cause of a lot of the Islamophobia. And so that means that we as Muslims need to reach out to people in the West and have a kind of a dialogue to help assuage those fears.
Well, but see, this is very important, and I agree with what you said. However, a great deal of the fear or the phobia in the West towards Islam, actually, it's not just because it's Islam. No. If you look at the Western civilization today, the Western world, yeah, let me call it the Western world. I will keep this word civilization away. You find that Europe was the main defender of Christianity over the last 1,000 years or so. Today, intellectuals and historians refer to Europe as post-Christian Europe. Like if you read the history of the Middle Ages in Europe, the Europeans were afraid that they would run out of land to build cathedrals. Like they were building cathedrals so much that they were worried actually that there is not more land in Europe to build more cathedrals. Yeah. That was in the Middle Ages when the popes had a word, and the kings and the monarchs in Europe were all trying to please the pope. And then happened the split between the Protestant and the Roman Catholic Church. And then gradually, actually, the cathedrals in Europe today, if you visit them, you will find that they have become tourist attraction. So Christianity is almost dying in Europe, almost. Yeah. In Canada, and I lived in Canada for over 15 years, the people who go to churches hide that fact from the people they know. Why? Because in Canada now, if you go to church, then you are looked at as a weird person. There must be something wrong with you. So Christianity also is dying in Canada. And that's not because of Islam. It's because the people actually are finding that the religion does not really fulfill their needs in life in terms of spirituality and stuff like that, because it's all based on your personal connection with Christ. And we all know that actually Christ is just a human being like any one of us, and his job was to link us to the Creator, not to himself. Yeah. But because the foundation now is wrong, the people are leaving the religion. Here in America, which is almost the last bastion of Protestant Christianity, Christianity also is actually dying in America here. The people are reinterpreting the Bible to suit what becomes politically correct and stuff like that. The people are leaving churches. In fact, there are churches out there now that are worried that their membership is declining so fast that they cannot even keep up with the costs of maintaining even the building and stuff like that. And I am predicting, actually, that within this century, within the 21st century, the situation of Christianity in America will be more or less actually like the situation of Christianity in Europe today.
Which interesting. Is, you know, the Pew survey recently published a huge projection of religious trends worldwide through 2050. And it wasn't that extreme, but it did find that Christianity was likely to decline quite a bit. Islam will become the world's most populous religion.
Yeah, this is very fact. Yeah, and it will even become very the most populous one in Europe and here in North America as well in the future. There is no denying that, and that could be proven by facts, by research, yeah, like you just mentioned.
So if we go out as Muslims to talk to Christians, especially serious Christians, they're probably not going to be very happy at this news. And it does seem to me that with the Christians, we need to reassure them that, you know, Muslims are not saying that you can't be a Christian, that there's only one way to God, and that's my way, and that we have nothing against their love of Jesus. On the contrary, in Islam, Jesus is virtually the same figure, with the exception of the crucifixion. But all of the message of Jesus is there. Jesus, the holy figure born of a virgin, the Ruh al-Qudus, the Holy Spirit, is all there in Islam. You can basically still be a Christian in an Islamic culture, and you're not going to be all that different from your Muslim neighbors.
This is very true. And actually, the main point of difference between the Muslim and the Christian is the divinity of Christ. That's actually the main difference between the two, is the disagreement over the nature of Christ himself. But other than that, there is not really much difference between the two. I just want to go back again to the point that you started with, which is the cause behind the Islamophobia in the West. I am saying that it's not a matter of Islamophobia. There is phobia in the West in general against religion of any kind. And that's the reason for the decline of the situation of Christianity in Europe. And it's now showing up in Canada and even here in the United States.
Well, we have a few minutes, Ibrahim, and we haven't yet even mentioned 9/11, which is a topic that we're associated with. So do you think that 9/11 might have been designed by people who are trying to create a post-religious New World Order, and it was designed not just to launch a war on Islam, but actually to turn Christians and Muslims against each other so that the religious people would tear each other apart?
Oh, there is no doubt about that. There is plenty of people now in the West here who make their money by wars. It's actually very obvious that the United States economy is known to be a war economy. So some people wanted to have an enemy after the collapse of the Soviet Union to scare the West about and then rationalize their drive to have more weapons and more wars. And what is better enemy out there to have than Muslims? Yeah. So, yes, I do agree fully that actually the people who did 9/11 are not Muslims. They are Westerners, and they have their desire to have the West to go to war, endless war almost, against the biggest threat to them in the world, which is Islam, because Islam makes people worship their God. Those people who did 9/11 want people to worship money, to worship themselves. Yeah. So that would be the biggest threat to them. Is this, like, they now succeeded in almost destroying Christianity, almost, yeah. Half the Jews out in the world now do not even believe in God at all, almost half the Jews. You must have heard of things like Jew, like Buddhist Jew or Jewish Buddhist. And so there is almost death now of other religions in the world continuing. And the biggest one actually that's out there, that's not dying, it's actually expanding, is Islam. So they did 9/11 in order to have this war between the West, which they control financially and militarily, and then the biggest threat out there, which is Islam. I fully agree with that.
Very interesting. And I think one of the best ways to get in the way of the people trying to push this New World Order post-religious Freemasonic agenda on the world is to work to unite the faiths, and not just unite people within Islam, as we've been talking about, but also to unite Muslims, Christians, and Jews of goodwill, and people, Buddhists, and whatever, people of all religious faiths who understand that there's more to the world than just consuming and seeking power and pleasure. All that stuff might be okay for a while in its place, but ultimately the meaning of life is much, much, much bigger, and we need to live for something much bigger than ourselves. Those of us who are Muslims are living for our relationship with God, which is described as submission. That's what Islam means. And we're going to have to continue this dialogue later, because I think we've hit the end of the hour. But Ibrahim, do you have anything else to add briefly here?
Yeah, I just want to summarize again that yes, we Muslims need to have dialogues with non-Muslims, but in order to have that be effective and productive, we have to have also a dialogue between ourselves as Muslims. Go back to re-practicing the old system of shura, which is consultation based on dialogue and exchange of ideas and information. And we also need to get over our little tribal thinking of whether you are Iranian or Saudi Arabian or Egyptian. No, we are all Muslims in the first place. We are all followers of Muhammad. And believe it or not, for non-Muslims, you don't have to become Muslim. But just listen to someone like Dr. Jeffrey Lang. Just Google the name of Jeffrey Lang and then listen to a lecture he gave about how he went from being a Roman Catholic to an atheist to a Muslim. You don't have to follow him exactly, but just see the line of thinking and see how impressive that is. And you might actually benefit from just listening to somebody like Jeffrey Lang.
Jeffrey Lang.
Kevin, very much.
Well, thank you, Ibrahim. I will check that out. This is Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, speaking with Ibrahim Sudi of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And I'm sure we'll carry this on at some future point, inshallah. So thank you, Ibrahim.
Schools, we don't need them. Can you please call the fire department? They down here marching for freedom. Burn down ATPs, turn ATVs on to teach them and move. The more money that they make, the more money that they make, the better and better they live. Whatever they wanna take, whatever they wanna take, whatever, whatever it is. The more that you wanna learn, the more that you try to learn, the better and better it gets. America, yeah. Now the poor Ku Klux Man see that we all brothers, not 'cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's grain. Now that's man, can't burn his cross, 'cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker. Nigga, they ain't living properly. Break them off with a little democracy. Turn their whole culture to a mockery. Give them Coca-Cola for their property. Give them gum, give them guns, get them young, give them fun. But if they ain't giving it up, then they ain't getting none.
give him some. It's the paper, some of these cops must be Al-Qaeda, nigga. I'm on my